I apologize in advance. I'm in an apartment in Edinburgh where I think the internet is a little bit spotty, so apologies if I cut in and out. Sorry about that. So we're very honored today to have as our colloquium speaker Karen Uhlenbeck, who about 8 years ago retired, had for a long time been at the University of Texas at Austin, and is now retired there, and since then has been at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. Professor Uhlenbeck won the 2019 Abel Prize, which is often described as the Nobel Prize in Mathematics. And I can do no better than quote their citation. It was for, quote, her pioneering achievements in geometric partial differential equations, gauge theory, and integrable systems, and for the fundamental impact of her work on analysis, geometry, and mathematical physics. Today she will tell us about Noether's theorem, so a little bit about their history and a bit about recent applications. And Professor Uhlenbeck, whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Thank you. I'm pleased at the opportunity to talk on Noether's theorems. 2 years ago, I had a little interest in the topic, but however, in the last year, 2 years, my interest has led in a direction which altered my attitude completely. I needed them for my present work, and I came to be sorry that I had not understood their roles in several topics I had to learn in the past. And I'll mention where that is when I get to it. This talk is definitely from a mathematical perspective, although I'll throw in a little physics at the end of recent developments. But I apologize in advance because I realized that I've put a lot of things in the talk, which was designed for a mathematical audience, which is basic elementary mathematics that I suspect that physicists tend to know, even though mathematicians don't. And so if it's a little elementary, I assure you the mathematicians don't know all this stuff. And also that I may have used some mathematics that mathematicians are familiar with. And one of the ones that just came up was hyperbolic surfaces. So I will actually try to put in some of the things that I didn't explain to the mathematics audience for you. Okay. Here's a rough outline of my talk. It's kind of long, so it could be that the first part is a little bit of the history with some basic examples. And the second part is just some of the type of work where I needed the theorems and some work that I've found in recent papers I found in the literature. Okay. Many people, including non-academics, became aware in 2015 that Einstein's theory of general relativity was announced in 1915. This theory did not come out of thin air. During its formative period, there were a group of mathematicians keep competing with Einstein, as well as cheering him on. In particular, Einstein visited Göttingen in 1915 and gave a series of lectures to the mathematicians there, which were enthusiastically received. Correspondence between David Hilbert and Einstein followed, and Hilbert himself made the contribution with a variational formulation of Einstein's equations, the integral that's usually referred to as the Einstein-Hilbert integral. One of the puzzlements of the new theory was that no conservation laws for energy and momentum could be found in the new equations. These had been readily discovered in special relativity, which had made the correspondence between energy and momentum clear. Sorry. In 1915, Emmy Noether had been invited by Hilbert and Klein to come to Göttingen and had probably been in the audience for Einstein's seminar lectures. Miss Noether, as she was referred to at the time, was the daughter of a mathematician, Max Noether, and sister to another mathematician, Fritz Noether. At the time, higher education in Germany was not open to women, but she had managed to write her doctoral thesis in 1907 in Erlangen under the supervision of the algebraist Paul Gordon. She had published a number of papers in invariant theory, and it appears that Hilbert simply assigned her the problem of looking into to the problem of conservation laws for energy and general relativity. From surviving correspondence at the Times, it appears there was preliminary results as early as 1916, but it was not until 1918 that the breakthrough insight, which explained the problem, came. Her paper, Invariant Variational Problems, was presented in July of 1918 with a dedication to Felix Klein on the 50th anniversary of his doctorate. Actually, that's rather nice. I would have liked such a present on the 50th anniversary of my doctorate, I think. Rather than start from scratch with definitions, I will state the theorem and develop the ideas by example and clarification. What I say will be familiar to applied mathematicians and physicists. Part one of the theorem says if we have an integral I, which is invariant under a group G of dimension rho, then there are rho linearly independent combinations among the Lagrangian expressions, which become divergences, and conversely. Part two says if the integral I is invariant under a group G rho infinity, depending on rho arbitrary functions and their derivatives up to order k, then there are rho identities among the Lagrangian expression and their derivatives up to order k, and conversely. This is actually Noether's notation, g rho infinity, and she seems to have, well, more about that later. Okay, so the integrals in Noether's theorem of an extremely general form. I mean, they involve any number of functions and any number of derivatives of functions in a region in Rn. And the function is a vector valued function. And here m is the number of vectors. And the derivatives involved are a multi-index derivative indicating the partials up through some fixed order. I mean, I learned about these in PDE books when I studied as a graduate student. We now call fdx a volume value function on the jet bundle of all things. The function f is classically called the Lagrangian. However, Noether discusses symmetries of the Lagrangian density L equal fdx. That's dx, the volume element in n space. And this is appropriate because when you're going to change variables, you change variables in the Lagrangian density. So some of the first variational problems, like the Bierkrister cone, like the ones we actually use in geometry, do involve minimizing. Many involve finding critical point. At a minimum, or generally a critical point, the first variation under an arbitrary deformation equals zero. This was a trick known to Newton. This was a trick. Essentially, someone suggested it might have been invented by Newton. The equations derived in this fashion are called the Euler-Lagrange equation. The general form of the Euler-Lagrange equations for most general example of Noether's is the system of equations, which is very complicated. And I just write it down to, we will actually not actually deal with complicated. Hilbert's integrand for general relativity, the Lagrangian density, is, as you know, the scalar curvature. And the volume form is just the induced volume on the space-time by the metric, and it's a function of the metric. So the Euler-Lagrange equations are simply that the Ricci curvature vanishes. And actually in mathematics, we think of this process of finding the Euler-Lagrange equations is a straightforward process of taking a derivative in a function space. But actually, I use the old-fashioned terminology, which I think is the one that you will use, which is the writing down delta U and delta I for the variations, because we are actually not working in a specific function space anyway. So it's just confusing to start talking about function spaces. For general relativity, the partials up to order two are required, but all for most of the examples in this talk, it is sufficient to think of L as a function with the derivatives of a vector value function. By this means we only need to have one derivative, and it simplifies all the notions and the ideas very much. Not that the others aren't important, but actually for most of our examples, just in writing the function of the first derivative and the function. By invariant, she does not mean the problem at hand is invariant. It does not mean that we pose a problem and there's a symmetry which leaves the problem invariant. She means that the Lagrangian density itself is. And this actually confused me very much as a student. And in fact, the example that I'm going to talk about, or the main motivation, the symmetries are not symmetries of the problem. They're symmetries of the integrand. Actually, L only needs to be invariant up to a divergence, if you like, or an exact end form. The theorem is local, not global in nature, and applies as it was originally stated in local Euclidean spaces or manifolds irrespective of topology or boundary. It's actually phrased in such a way that you really don't have to worry about changing coordinates, because it's actually phrased to be stated on manifolds. Notice theorem really uses infinitesimal symmetries, or the action of the Lie algebra. For practical purposes, a group action is much easier to identify. I know from hard experiences, and in fact, this is my relation with physicists. I find physicists often use the Lie algebra symmetries, whereas if you write down the problem in terms of the actual global Lie group symmetries, it's much simpler to understand. Anyway, her symmetries involves group would act on the domain and the range of Y of F as needed in general relativity. So her symmetries in general relativity act together on the domain and on the range and intertwine the two. And the examples I'm going to use don't intertwine the two, so they're somewhat simpler. But it shows the completeness of the theorem. A rough idea of her proof is more useful than the proof. To each of the row symmetries, the function at the function u, where the variation of the integral vanishes, you identify the infinitesimal variations of the function that come from the symmetry. So you vary them. And Noether gives an explicit formula for this, but in your own problem, you can usually figure out what the variations are from the symmetry. And the first step, so that's the main step of computing it. Then you multiply each symmetry by an arbitrary function of small support. You could compute the variation of the integral in the direction, the sum of du of all the different ones you have here. And remember, phi is arbitrary. It's only locally defined, but phi is a function of x, phi of b is a function of x depending on the symmetry b. And so you compute it in that direction. Sorry. In general, for any integral which depends only on first derivatives, your formula will look something like this. You'll get a complicated definition here, but you'll get it out of the computation of what you're doing. And here you get a term. And since only first derivatives were involved, you're only going to get the arbitrary functions, the variations, and the derivatives of them. But the fact that the integral is invariant under the symmetry means that WB vanishes. You can take that actually as the definition of the symmetry, that WB will always vanish. And then you get a formula which says that zero is equal to the inner product of the sums of the V's times the derivatives of the phi's, and you integrate by parts. And you use the fundamental theorem in the calculus of variations, which is what we call it, which says that divergences of the V's all vanish. And so you get, for each symmetry, you get a V whose which is a vector field whose derivative vanishes. So that's element. That's okay. So yeah. Oh, okay. So I'm sorry, I was going to skip this, but from this is not it, how to prove the second theorem is the same thing, only this time we don't need the Euler-Lagrange equations. We just know that this vanishes for all the variations that are computed from the symmetry on any function, whether it solves the equation or not. And so you do the same process, but you immediately get the divergence of V vanishes where V is defined on any function. I mean, I think physicists call that off shell, and solving the equation is on shell. So the point is, Noether calls these improper symmetries, and they're basically useless. I mean, that is, you that's so. Oh, by the way, the ones that come out of general relativity are the Bianchi identities. But I mean, you already knew them, so that you didn't learn anything by calculating them from. And in fact, they were known in Noether's time. So I was going to run through some examples. These are probably not necessary. Maybe I'll go. I just give the example here of a function of one variable, or I should say a vector value function of one variable. And you compute the Euler-Lagrange equations, which I really have a feeling all physicists are common. And then if the functional f is doesn't have a t in it, then f dt, the Lagrangian density, is invariant under time translation. We don't care about the boundary conditions or anything. And so we have, in fact, in one variable, you get the very simple elementary first year calculus formula for conservation of energy. So that's so the point is that as this example, it was Noether who actually pointed out that the relationship between the symmetry and the conservation law. Now, and for n equal to, I found this very amusing, so I included it here. If you want to look at example part two of the theorem, let's take a curve in a manifold and we minimize length instead of energy. So we get the integral of the length of a derivative of a function computed with respect to some norm, which can be any norm at all, but it just as long as it doesn't have a t in it, dt. And then when you actually go through to compute the energy, which you think, ah, we might have a nice energy here, you get a very nice formula that basically says, well, I mean, the inner product of f dot with f dot is the norm squared, and we're dividing by the norm. And over here we get the norm, and so we get zero. So it's absolutely trivial, and it's something that you wouldn't even think about it. And then the explanation is that the time translation is embedded in the group of reparameterizations of the integral, and the integral is invariant under all reparameterization. So, and there's no energy. So that's the explanation for the general relativity. Oh, yeah, I want to make a comment about this because Noether's theorem is quoted quite a bit in Hamiltonian mechanics. And this comes about because of the classical Legendre transformation between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian mechanics. And so it really is a theorem in Lagrangian mechanics, but it does apply in Hamiltonian mechanics and is used quite a bit. Okay. Okay. I just want to, yeah. Actually, maybe I'll skip this one. Right. Oh, I just to I will why was this known to Noether's contemporaries as a conservation law? Well, maybe I should go through. I'm sorry. To get the invariant formulation, okay, we we write where we got the conservation laws in this form. And then you integrate by parts and you get the divergence equals zero when you get a vector field is divergence equals zero. But what we do in the coordinate invariant fashion, because actually the notion of the divergence is actually dependent somewhat on the metric, and we want to change metrics, is that if that we actually take the inner product of a vector field with the n form of the, with the density form, that makes an n minus one form, and we call that theta. And the equations basically that we got from applying the symmetry say the integral of theta wedge d phi is zero. And now, of course, in modern mathematics, that's just the distributional. The definition of when the derivative of theta equals zero. Theta doesn't have to have any other properties. It doesn't have to have derivatives or anything. If that happens, you say theta is zero as a distribution. Okay, so why was this known to Noether's contemporaries as a conservation law? Simply the divergence theorem. And this is one thing which I'm sure you know, and my mathematics audience doesn't necessarily know. But that if you take this n minus one form and you integrate it over the boundary of a domain, say you have two pieces to the boundary, the difference is the integral of d theta over zero. I mean, in Euclidean spaces, it's called divergence, but we can do this in space-time, and we don't need to have a particular metric, and we get d theta equals zero. And of course, the standard application in applied mathematics is to take the time slices constant time and integrate over the constant time slices, and the conservation law is the integral over the different time slices is equal to as you move the time slices. So that's okay. So great theorem, huh? So they actually accomplished two things. And they showed that many, if not all, of the known conservation law in both physics and mathematics arise from symmetries. They also problemed the sign to her. And I mentioned this before, but I'll go over it. The conservation laws, such as those of special relativity in particular, come from translation in time, and those of momentum come from translation in space. In general relativity, these translations are embedded in the group of diffeomorphisms, which leave the Einstein-Hilbert-Lagrangian invariant. Hence, they give rise to identities, not conservation laws. And it was actually a couple years later that Schouten and Stroop published the proof that the Bianchi identities were the. So how are the theorems received? I'm relying on a reference to a Cosman-Schwarz book, which is a whole book on the Noether theorems and how they're applied, and actually quite a bit of information about how they are applied in more recent times. Attention was paid to them at first, and they're mentioned in correspondence among Einstein, Hilbert, Klein, and their associates. Her work was referenced in talks and papers in the next few years, and then a surprisingly little attention was paid to them in the ensuing years until the 1960s. The two reasons that Cosman-Schwarz back suggests is at that time, the importance of variational formulations was not recognized. This is a surprise to me, because ever since I've been around I know that physics problems have always come into me with variational formulations, sometimes when the mathematicians have forgotten it. But anyway, and they did not seem to have any applications. So several revolutions of developments in physics and mathematics changed everything. And at this point, the group theory appeared in quantum mechanics. And group theory had simply not been recognized as something that was of vital interest in physics. But this group theory and symmetry became very important in the quantum revolution. And so her work. I actually also point out that at least what I learned about quantum mechanics, when I was learning the classical mechanics it was derived from, it was always given in the variational formulation. So the calculus of variations was also became more common. Now, the development of finite integrals and the development of quantum field theory, Lagrangians and their critical points became suddenly very central, and groups were already present. So, I mean, at the moment that we had finite integrals, we were suddenly interested in variational problems and symmetry. So, another development, which I actually really don't myself understand, is that when gauge theory came to describing fundamental particles, it's clear her discussion of the groups modeled on arbitrary functions was seen as a prophecy out of the past. In fact, her theorems, the way her theorems are used in gauge theory is not even that clear to me, because they certainly aren't used in the fact that the integrands are gauge symmetric, because the gauge symmetries are actually groups of infinite groups depending on a number of functions. And so the symmetries that arise from in a Lagrangian problem from the gauge groups are absolutely very trivial. And I found some comments on and by physicists who don't realize this on the web. It's true. But I think they appear, I'll say, in the Hamiltonian formulation of the generation of gauge transformations. But this is one thing which I'm very curious about, is why people in gauge theory are so interested in Noether's theorems. And another place where they appear is the classical theory of completely integrable ordinary differential equations and Hamiltonian mechanics found its way into the development of infinite hierarchies of partial differential equations. And then again, this is something I don't really understand, but it's certainly true that the ideas behind that's developed by physicists behind supersymmetry are actually somehow embedded originally in Noether's theorem. And I wish I had known this when I had tried to learn about supersymmetry. And I think if I'd followed that track down, I would be much better for it. And I did a literature search on MathSciNet, and actually applied mathematicians and I think physicists actually use this is part of the toolkit. It is not part of the toolkit for mathematics and geometry, but I think a loss. So the theorems were rediscovered many times, sometimes independently and sometimes from the papers themselves. In many of the new developments, there is only a faint shadow of the theorems themselves, but the association of symmetry and conservation laws is now the accepted philosophy in physics and mathematics, which is an idea due entirely to Noether. So the references increase in time. I'm doing pretty well. Okay, so why am I interested in them? I've spent a career doing all sorts of things, like a lot about PDE and gauge theory, and I spent a lot of time trying to understand things like supersymmetry. And I also, because of the appearance of integral systems and conformal field theory, I spent a lot of time trying to understand integral systems. And I actually never thought, I knew Noether's theorem. It was assigned to me by my advisor when I was a graduate student, but I don't think I understood it and I never used it. And in fact, they are seldom mentioned in the literature of global analysis, which is the field that I roughly work in. So what problem did I come to? And I'll try to explain the a former student came to me and suggested we look into the analytical underpinnings of Thurston's best Lipschitz map between hyperbolic surfaces. Now, here I'm going to draw a picture and talk a little here because I think so a hyperbolic surface is an N-hold. This is a two-hold. This is a two-hold torus, but it has a special metric on it. It has a metric of constant curvature. Constant curvature minus one. Okay. Now it's a big subject in mathematics to study the relationship of two hyperbolic surfaces of the same genus. They may look very different in shape. And you want to know the relation of this. And this is generally done by studying a map between this of a special type. So this is a special map. And Teichmuller theory, these are very rigid. There's a whole family of surface of metrics, a finite dimensional family depending on genus of surfaces, and it's a very very big subject in mathematics to study this. It's called Teichmuller theory. And a Teichmuller map actually says Teichmuller map says that there's a coordinate system on here and a coordinate system on here, global coordinate system here, so that the stretch factor in along these surfaces is lambda, and along the perpendicular surfaces the stretch factor is 1 over lambda. And there are actually some isolated points where you have singularities so that's a Teichmuller map, and that's the basic for how to study it. But there are other ways to actually study these surfaces, including finding harmonic maps. I mean, that's the finding harmonic maps. But and Thurston, Thurston's idea was, well, no, let's not find a map which stretches one direction by lambda and the other direction by 1 over lambda. Let's find the map that has the least stretching, that it maps. It maps M to N, and it actually stretches. It stretches the least, and this is done by defining the Lipschitz constant of a function to be the maximum distance of f of x from f of x to f of y divided by the distance between x and y. And we want to find a u such that the Lipschitz map of u is less than or equal to the Lipschitz constant of any other maps. So there's a 1995, that's a long time ago. So it's not something that by Bill Thurston, which proposes to base a Teichmuller theory on the properties of these best Lipschitz map between hyperbolic surfaces. The preprint is still in circulation, and the contents of it have been worked over a lot by topologists, but actually no one actually looked at trying to do the analysis. Now, it's a minimization problem. That is, we're trying to minimize the stretch of a map between two objects. And how is it connected with the calculus of variations? Well, the point is that it's not a calculus of variations problem, which is a very definite definition. But like many things, it's on the border. That is, we can approximate it by if we take the integral of the maps to the eigenvalues of the map to the pth power and integrate it, we get an ordinary variational problem. And then in the limit, we'll actually get some sort of map that's a best Lipschitz map. And we wanted to understand that. So So the problem that we actually started out with, and I just, is the variational problem where we just took a map to a circle. So you want to start out, you want to map a manifold M to a manifold N. So the best, easiest manifold to study is the circle. And you look at the pth power of the derivative. And you compute it in the Riemannian manifold on the surface. So the Riemannian manifold of the surface is actually coming in here because you're using the metric for that. And you don't have a boundary value problem, which is, again, but the but fixing the homotopy class of the map that gives a homotopy version takes the place of any boundary conditions, and you get a unique solution up to rotation in the circle of the Euler-Lagrange equations, which are actually simply written. And the point is on forms, the covariant derivative on the metric is the same as the derivative of the ordinary differential in flat space. And so we actually discovered that we can actually solve the star of this du, p minus 2 du is a 2. This is a 1 form. So this is a 1 form. So it's d of a function. And the point is that we discovered this, and we discovered that these, turns out that in the limit as p goes to infinity, these objects became some very important object, important thing in topology called a transverse measure. And we kind of popped out completely unexpected. Now, when we try to do this, again, to mapping hyperbolic manifolds to hyperbolic manifolds, we actually got the right integral and we proceeded all along and everything went very well, but we could not find the equivalence of this. We could not find the equivalent of our closed one forms. And of course, and then, but what actually happened, we then remember Noether. And of course, when we mapped M to S1, S1 has a beautiful symmetry, it's rotation, right? So the integral is invariant under rotation. And lo and behold, what we had actually discovered here was the one closed one form. This is dvp. The DVP that is corresponds to the one-dimensional symmetry. And that was the thing that we carried to infinity and actually found a transverse measure. So once we realized this, and here I'm going to draw another picture here because, well, no, not, no, let me just, okay. So actually we also found something very interesting in the conserved quantities that I've never seen commented on before. And that is the actual conserved quantities themselves satisfied variational problems. And that is integrating, if you integrate the derivative of the function to the pth power, and you construct the dual charge that comes from applying Noether's theorem, you get a V, which satisfies the Euler-Lagrange equations of dv to the q dx, where q is 1 over q plus 1 over p is equal to 1. And I've never seen that in the literature before, but anyway, that's just a comment. So we found, right. Now, I just wanna, the most interesting thing that came out of our work, however, was the following, and we don't even know. That is, we were finding best Lipschitz maps from a domain to a target. And actually what we had done is we had used Noether's theorem on the target. And we found all this interesting stuff happening that looked good. And then we thought to use Noether's theorem on the domain. And this is that we just idly thought about it now that we knew about Noether's theorem. And now this, you know about this already. Because when you have a Lagrangian density that is in Rn, which is a function of the function and the derivative of the function, but not the variable x. When you actually compute the Euler-Lagrange equation, you actually get an energy momentum tensor. And I haven't written the formulas for it, but you may be familiar with a problem like this. Well, and energy, and the property of the energy momentum tensor will be that it's a square thing, and you call it the divergence. The divergence in either the rows or it's symmetric, and the divergence is in the rows and columns are zero. Now we're in Riemannian geometry on a Riemannian manifold, and here the metric appears only in the volume form, and we have to actually say what's the equivalent of x not appearing in the interval. And there it just says if you just take the integral to be of the function of the function, and then a quadratic differential, it's just you take the inner product in the derivative variables, and you keep these free, and you get a square matrix, and the integral can be a function of that. So in that case, we always get I call it momentum tension, because we tend to work in space, not space-time. So then you get a momentum tensor, which satisfies which is also divergence-free in the rows and columns. It's symmetric for the same reasons. The symmetric however, this is the covariant derivative, not the regular derivative, and you can't really perform the same operations as the covariant derivative. But then we discovered that when you're on a symmetric space and you have Killing vector fields, if you take the inner product of the momentum tensor with the local Killing vector field, that also is that's one of Noether's co-closed one forms. And so Noether's theorem is appearing here. So we have the ability to actually work with the symmetries of the domain and the symmetries of the range. And we're still figuring out how you link them, but that's okay. Okay, so I'll just go on to describe what we did in dimension two. So we actually found a very interesting equation. So if you take this energy momentum tensor and you take its dual in both variables, it's a 1-1 tensor. And if you take its dual, you're going to get a tensor in forms, which are n minus 1, n minus 1 forms. But for n equal 2, you can just take the dual of a 1 form, and you get another 1 form. And this energy momentum tensor has a dual, just getting by. I mean, you have epsilon ijs, and you compute with the epsilon ijs, and you just reverse the both indices. And what we discovered was that the equation the divergence of this momentum tensor is zero, is valid if and only if there's a potential function E, so that this tensor itself is the covariant derivative of dE plus the scalar curvature of G times E. Now, this is only true on a symmetric surface. You can actually check quite easily that it's true. If R is constant, then you can check that that the covariant derivative of S will vanish. If R is not constant, that'll mess up the formula. So it's something that's true only in constant curvature. Okay. So it's interesting that we specifically get a formula. Let's see. So what happens in two dimensions for our two-dimensional surfaces, in fact, all of our surfaces. We have M, a hyperbolic surface, and the kernel of this map is it functions, you can think of functions on the universal cover. And the Ks are the kernel of it. And the point is that you can start on the surface here and you can find E, and then you can move E all the way around, which is the, and when you come back to the same place again, then you've actually got a different E, but that's the holonomy. The holonomy around the curve is a different E, but the difference is an element in the kernel, a three-dimensional kernel. So that way you actually construct a bundle over, then you can actually define, given any curve on the surface, you can define an element in the kernel by taking the difference of the kernel and the kernel that you, the element of the kernel you get when you go, the element of the solution that you get when you go around. And so, so in this case, so the this is a very interesting equation, and we get a bundle over a surface anytime we have such an S. So, it's such an elementary fact that the fact that it's not. I mean, I have a feeling probably somebody knows it somewhere. But okay. So I just wanted to say something about. Actually, many theorems in geometric analysis are very general, but in fact, examples treating special cases are usually the ones that are actually found. And in those cases, there are many, many examples of that have to do with technical things called monotonicity theorems and so forth, which are actually directly results of Noether's theorem, but they were actually found without realizing Noether's theorem. In fact, it's in hindsight, you go back and you say, oh yes, that equation comes from the fact that there's a symmetry. And when you have some calculus variation invariant under symmetry, you get a conserved quantity. And that's the formula that we're using for this identity. So here's another example, and I actually left it in because I thought that you might find the problem with the problem kind of amusing. This is, we'll take a torus and we'll just map it into R3. Right. And so here it sits in R3, and we're gonna map it. That is, you can do this. So actually, we'll draw a round torus, and we'll map it into a curly torus, and we'll do an integral over the surface, over the torus, d2. And what we'll take in the integrand is h df dx, d mu f. H is this function, h is the second fundamental form. It's very basic geometry. I mean, most people don't know the formula of it, but it actually just does, it does describe something about how the surface is curved. So it's a curvature identity. And you also get a metric, you also get a volume or a surface area, and you integrate with respect to the surface area. And this is the Willmore function. Now it's been around for a long time, and the guess was there's actually a very special surface. If you take S1 cross S1 and you embed this into R4, by the obvious thing, that is, you take S1 to R2 and S1 to R2, then this will sit in go into R4, but it actually sits in S3 that sits in R4. And so this is called Clifford torus, right? Clifford torus. But S3 is conformally invariant to R4 minus a point. So This is the same problem in S3 as it is in R3. And so the Lagrangian has that form. And so there's an improper set of integrals of identities. So the reparameterizations form a symmetry, which depends on two functions of two variables. And the Euclidean group acts on the torus. The special property of the integral that it is very under dilations of R3. Actually, you can just figure that out easily because the second fundamental form and the surface actually go in opposite directions when you expand. So the F is invariant under the full conformal group. And so the calculations that needed to carry out the proof, so it is known that it is the Clifford torus, and it was proved by a different method. So the identities you get from applying Noether's theorem to the conformal group of R3 produce some identities which were needed to prove to carry out the proof. And on the other hand, they were found without Noether's theorem. This is kind of the historical interesting. Okay, so that's. So I can give anybody the I do recommend that reference for that because he actually goes into lots of other places where Noether's theorem is used without realizing it. And I did promise to put a little physics in, although it wants not too much because I don't understand it very well. One of my colleagues heard an earlier version of this talk and said and pointed me to a very recent paper on physics using Noether's theorem. I'm sort of hesitant to include it because the physics construction needs a lot of translation into the mathematics language to understand. But the paper is A Shorter Path to Celestial Currents by Sabrina Pertersky. It derives the warp identities of Strominger to obtain identities based on the conformal compactification of spacetime. In fact, my own collaborator, Julian Turn, had heard Strominger talk and thought we should look at it. And the calculations in the paper are, this comes back to gauge theory. So I just thought I'd add that. The calculations in the paper are based on something which I hadn't actually known before, which is, I had only known in an indefinite way. That is the gauge symmetries. if you have a curvature, right, then it turns out that the curvature is what we call in mathematicians in two dimensions, the curvature is what's called a moment map. And if I take the curvature, and I take the inner product with a function, this is a space-time, and I integrate it over S2, or a three-dimensional surface, and I look at the variational calculation for this, I treat this as a Hamiltonian. Treat it as a Hamiltonian. And I look at that, I do the Hamiltonian calculation using the skew symmetry, the fact that in on an S2, there's a natural A wedge B is a natural symplectic form. And you can compute the gauge transformations using this identity. And in fact, this calculation and so it becomes a problem in Hamiltonian mechanics. And the paper actually uses this to derive the fact that when you have a surface going down to minus infinity and a surface going to plus infinity, you get identities where they meet at the conformal sphere of infinity, which are useful. So anyway, I don't know if that explanation, that's what I understand about it and so forth. Anyway, so that's just about all I have to say. And I hope you feel the Noether's theorems are still in the toolbox of many branches of mathematics and physics, and despite their age, are still worth keeping dusted off on top. Anyway, thank you, and I hope it wasn't too mathematical and the physics wasn't too wrong.
Okay, thank you. Feel free to unmute and thank Professor Ulenbeck for her talk. Let me begin by asking if there are any questions from students. Any student want to venture a question before I open the floor?
I have a question. Maybe one of the students can answer it. That's Do you still answer. Learn the relation between Hamiltonian and Lagrangian mechanics?
Yes, the answer is yes, yes.
Good, I'm glad.
Are there any other questions?
That's not a good sign.
No, I'll give it one more moment. If there are not, I have a feeling that the audience is still chewing over the trying to understand the stuff that came along in the second half, and it's one of these things that would benefit from if you were here in person, a little more discussion afterwards. But
you're not here in person. Are you here in person either?
No, I'm not. No. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Theo, what, you have a question?
Yeah. Okay. So. What was my question? So in the example that you were kind of talking about of your new stuff, was one of the things you mentioned was that the Lipschitz problem isn't actually really a variational problem, but it was at the boundary of it.
That's right.
Could you, and then you sort of made this comment that I didn't quite understand about moving, like you approximate it by variational problems. I understood that. Right. And then you got the kind of conserved quantities for those approximations. What do the limits of those conserved quantities, how do they look? Do they stay nice or like I guess I have much intuition.
That's a very good question.
And I should, or may not exist, or?
I should have said, they're actually measures. I mean, they're measures. So you have this, this dual quantity, which is this closed, one form, which you could think of as a derivative of a function. And it's actually a measure, and its support is on the lamination, which is where the Lipschitz constant is obtained. So what happens is you stretch the surface tight and it catches on a bunch of geodesics and it can't go any further. And the limit of the conserved quantity becomes a measure that has support on this lamination. And the point is that had been invented already, that measure, not in the same language. So we needed to translate it, but that measure had actually already been invented. And so we did discover, kind of like magic, that it was actually the limit of these dual one forms that appeared in Noether. From Noether.
Okay, thank you.
Actually, thank you for the question, because it occurs to me that that's a good thing to say in the talk.
Maybe I have one quick question. I hadn't been familiar with this idea of Teichmuller theory and Teichmuller maps between different two surfaces of the same genus. Is that something that only is relevant for two-dimensional negatively curved surfaces, or does it also apply to higher
Yes.
dimensional ones?
Oh, yes. It's actually very important. It is only relative. If you go up in dimension, it's rigid. That is, if you go up in dimension and you have negatively curved things, there's only one in every homotopy. There's just only one in every homotopy class. So you can't
Okay.
deform them, and you can't put another one on them. It's a very basic theorem in higher dimensional hyperbolic geometry, which but it's very rigid. So.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, any final questions?
I was curious whether you knew that Sabrina is a faculty member here. Someone should have warned her to come. It looks like
I
she's been on the
see.
call.
No, in fact, I thought she was at Princeton, but because no, I thought she was at Princeton because that's what's on the paper, and I've been meaning to actually look her up. But I actually only looked at the paper a couple weeks ago, so
Oh,
I
okay.
haven't.
Yeah, she just moved here.
Okay. Well, it's. I'm going to. I am going to understand that paper. Meaning, I'm going to translate it into mathematics. It's interesting to me. It's really interesting to me how the styles are so different of how you write a physics paper and how you write a math paper. Because it's not a question of not knowing it. It's what you, the information you put in it at the beginning, and so.
All
Yeah,
right.
I'm very aware, right? I am mostly a mathematician, so I have seen the difference.
Right. Well, you know, there's surely sort of we actually start with definitions, and somehow or other, I think it rigid makes our th thinking more rigid. Somehow, in physics, you sort of start with the story, and you tell the story, and maybe it's easier to take sidelines if you're in the story. I mean, that's and but I mean also the fact is that well, anyway, that's. But I mean, I've had this trouble a long time, so that was. I mean, I tried forever to understand physics papers on supersymmetry, and they never made any sense to me at all. And but I turn other mathematicians have had the struggle too. So.
It's a very common experience.
Well,
All
thanks.
right. Well, let's thank Karen one more time for her talk.
Right.